From that raucous noise that was coming from the other side of the glass, that we had a full audience. So thank you to the five people who are over there right now.
Making all that racket. It's been awesome.
Welcome. We are the Atheist Experience. We're live today. It's March 15th, 2020. Does that always seem weird to you, like 2020? Or do you just go roll with it?
No, it feels weird to me.
Yeah. I'm always shocked. It's like, oh, it's not, 1989 anymore, despite, the clothes that I am wearing. Yeah, I wore a different shirt today. I was dressed by my girlfriend, had to wear Black Sabbath. Because how do you not? I mean, it's Black Sabbath. And here we are at the Atheist Experience live. I got a couple announcements to make. Thank you to everybody for tuning in. We've got a full list of callers that we're going to try to get to as soon as we can. But we, at the last board meeting, basically were talking about things that we needed to do related to coronavirus and this global pandemic and, perhaps some of the fear-mongering surrounding it or panic.
Yep.
But we need to put forward sound policies and do the right thing. And so we set up essentially five DEFCON levels. DEFCON 5 is everything's normal.
Okay.
DEFCON 4, which is what I moved us to the other day, is all the locals and regulars who would normally come down and fill the building on the Sunday or do activities at the building and stuff, stay away. Anybody who's sick, stay away. But if somebody made a special trip to Austin, as these five people have done, to come down, we're not going to turn them away. They're spread out pretty well in the audience. They're keeping a distance, and we are on fist bump at most protocols. People are washing their hands, and that's what we're doing for DEFCON 4, but the shows will continue as normal. If we go to DEFCON 3, which I fully expect, I will probably wind up moving us to DEFCON 3 maybe within this next week. It just depends. We are watching the news. We're listening to the reports. We are following what the World Health Organization, the CDC, and others are recommending. But we have kind of a small gathering here. At DEFCON 3, nobody comes to the building except for the hosts and the crew. That's it. The ACA Free Thought Library will be closed at all of the times. Even if you came in special from out of town, sorry, you can drive by and take a picture by the sign that's out front. And everything else is just here to make sure that we keep people safe, both the people involved in the show so that we can continue doing stuff and the people who might be guest visiting. At DEFCON 2, we go to even stricter protocols, which is the crew will be back there in the studio office there. And the hosts will either be, come through the door and sit down in here and have no interaction with anybody else, or we will remote in. But all the way up to DEFCON 2, we will continue to be doing shows, live shows, and everything else. At DEFCON 1, we just shut down. That by the time we get there, I don't think there's going to be too many people worried about watching.
The show must go on, right?
But largely, the show must go on. Now, along with that, there's so many cancellations. Not only did we mention last week Austin canceled South by Southwest, the NBA is doing the right thing, and they're canceling until further notice. And anywhere where there's these huge gatherings, it's funny to me that churches and church services, some of them have decided, no, no, no. There was a Greek Orthodox church that's like, God won't let disease get in here, so we're meeting anywhere. And I'm like, you guys are going to get sick.
Yeah.
And, you can't get access to holy water because that could be contaminated. And even the Lord miracle water stuff and all that. There's a lot going on related to this. I wanted to make the point that I was supposed to be, we still haven't canceled the Magic and Skepticism show that's happening at UT San Antonio on the 1st. I'm waiting to hear from them as to whether they want to postpone that, whether we're going to do it anyway. I need at least five audience members or the show won't work because I use volunteers throughout the show. So if they want to postpone, that's fine. But the following weekend, I was supposed to be in Phoenix, Arizona for the American Atheist National Convention. That has been postponed, not canceled, postponed for one whole year because American Atheist has partners in the Houston area. And they want a convention, and they deserve a convention. And so while we were going to announce next year, 2021's American Atheist was going to announce next year's convention in another city, What they've said is we are going to be in Phoenix in 2021. Same thing, Easter weekend. If you are already registered for the American Atheist Convention, you don't have to do anything other than deal with your hotel rooms and flights. Your registration will just roll over to next year's convention. But you can also find out more information at atheists.org. And there'll be a link there to convention, frequently asked questions. You can contact them. But we're going to be doing something special, the Atheist Community of Austin. And I'm not going to get into too much details, but because things could change. But the plan is for Easter weekend, there will be a lot of programming coming from this little studio in Texas. And it will include Nick Fish as president of American Atheists and vice president from American Atheists to talk a little bit about what happened, what they're doing moving forward, and perhaps a load of other special guests. But stay tuned, because anything could happen between now and then. The last kind of immediate announcement I have is that International Atheist Day is coming up this weekend, this coming weekend of the 21st, 22nd, 23rd. And we had planned to be on the steps of the Capitol here in Austin. We booked a PA system. We were having tons of speakers come in, including Seth Andrews and Mandisa Thomas and others. And Seth was going to come down to Austin, be the master of ceremonies for that. We were also going to do a special event at Trinity United Church. And a comedy show with Ian Harris, who was going to come down. And then some of them were going to be on Atheist Experience and all this stuff. We have had to go back to the emergency plan for that. And so many of the guests will not be coming to Austin, including Seth. Seth will not be coming to Austin. Mandisa will not be coming to Austin. Ian will not be coming, or at least not as far as I know. And we will not be at the Capitol, because even before the Capitol decided to close, we had already decided to move it from there to here. And now what's going to end up happening is we are going to be essentially live streaming what would have been happening at the Capitol with the individuals who were going to be involved, either offering up a pre-recorded speech in the case of some of the people who couldn't do it another way, or live streaming, or here in person. But do not come down to the building for that. I would imagine if the trend continues, because we're like a week and some change behind Italy, we will probably be at least at DEF CON 3 then, and for the ACA. Sorry, I got stuck in mid-swallow and it wouldn't do anything. But yeah, we're going to do everything we can. We're going to do what we can to keep shows going and shows running. And in order for us to do that, which not only allows us to discuss current events beyond coronavirus, but also to give updates on what's going on in our city and to potentially reach out to people in other cities as well, we need to stay healthy. And we need to make sure that we are implementing the right protocols here. And so while it's very sad that the American Atheist Convention got canceled and Atheist Day got moved to something much smaller and much more online, it's also smart. And so while we're all sad about the way things have had to go, the important thing is to keep people healthy, because some of us are either immune compromised or over the age limit or constantly around people who are immune compromised and over the age limit. Schools are shutting down because, let's face it, children are little fucking petri dishes. And yep. While they will probably all survive this, they're set to kill the rest of us.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. I like kids, just not yours. No, I'm kidding. I don't like mine either, because I don't have any. I like my niece and nephew. That's it. That's probably the extent of it. No, I'm just messing. How you doing?
I'm all right.
Don is here with us this week. Let's give a round of applause to Don Baker for championing the coronavirus pandemic to come in here to deliver. Do we have a failure?
It's sort of a failure, yeah.
It's sort of a failure. But you also have other news items and stuff to talk about as well.
I do. You know, there's I'm scratching my head about the toilet paper thing. I can't figure it out.
There
must be somebody online saying, if you wrap yourself in toilet paper and pour bottled water over yourself, it'll fix the whole thing.
It was, we had a hard time finding bleach, because evidently some people, there were recommendations for people to like drink bleach. Don't fucking do that.
Don't drink bleach.
Don't do that.
But wiping with bleach makes perfect sense to me, but the toilet paper I don't get.
Yeah.
Apparently Alex Jones and Jim Baker? News?
Among others.
Among others.
So when catastrophes happen and when fear-mongering begins, what happens? People like
the
us.
The hucksters come out, yeah.
People like us sit here and we continue to try to keep things at a sense of normalcy while also being responsible. And then there are the people who are supposedly morally superior and more understanding and more enlightened, and they know the things that they don't want you to know. And what do? They start to try to sell you shit. and I want all of them fucking sued into oblivion, and we have a couple of examples right now.
Okay, well, there's Alex Jones has been ordered by the New York State Attorney General to stop selling his sham anti-coronavirus toothpaste. I'm not making this up.
Anti-coronavirus toothpaste.
Yeah.
I wonder if you brush with that enough, can you pass a breathalyzer?
Right.
Because he didn't.
He didn't. Oops. And I guess Jim Baker is trying to sell, vitamins or something?
It's some kind of liquid. Silver buzzword coronavirus cure.
Yeah.
And silver isn't like Missouri suing him or something?
Yeah, Missouri. Yeah. So hooray for these states for going after these hucksters.
Meanwhile, if prayer worked, why would we be in this mess?
Right.
I mean, this should have never left China. Oh, wait, they're a godless nation. That's it.
That's right.
People here just weren't praying hard enough. Why don't you love people who had the coronavirus? Why didn't
you
pray?
The gays will get blamed at some point.
Right? The Bible specifically says, wherever two or more of you are gathered together in my name, whatever you ask for, I will give. And this is yet another example that either there is no God, that verse is a lie, or no two Christians have ever prayed for an end to the fucking coronavirus.
Right.
That's like, hang on. I have someone sent us this wonderful F-bomb. And since I'm dropping them left and right, we will sell you this F-bomb as a cure for the coronavirus for $2.3 million. I'm sure
that we're prohibited, caveat emptor, right?
It won't actually cure the coronavirus, but.
Right.
Anyway.
So I did bring a topic today, and it's gotcha questions. And I brought, thought of eight questions that are kind of, things you should ask your minister.
Ooh, are we we're quizzing ministers. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you were quizzing me. I was like, ooh, because there's all these videos, and I haven't bothered to do a response to them because so many of my friends have, but these preachers and these apologists will come out with, here's five questions atheists can't answer.
Oh, right.
And then
there's
like
no shortage of those.
Every atheist on the planet who's got a YouTube channel is like, hello, I can answer those, or I can at least explain why you've asked a question that can't be answered.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, a lot of folks claim to have a deep personal relationship with God, right, and the man upstairs. And if that's the case, you should be able to ask him a few questions about his motivations or the workings of the world. And furthermore, all people everywhere with that same sort of relationship with God should get the same answer.
I might have a lot of fun with this and occasionally put my Christian hat on, so I will.
That's fine. Please do.
Let's dance.
Okay. And God would never lie and tell one person one thing and another person another thing, right?
God is not a God of lies, although there are verses where he intentionally deceives people.
You're playing Christian advocate.
Yes, I am. There are verses where he intentionally deceives people and gives them over to reprobate mind as long as it serves his purpose. But when it says that God wouldn't lie, what it really means is that God wouldn't lie to a true, sincere follower
of
God.
So some of these folks are not true Christians.
Sure. When he hardens Pharaoh's hearts, or when there are various scribes and prophets and he gives them over to reprobate minds, or he deceives them, or when Jesus speaks in parables, he's intentionally speaking so that some people will not understand. And I view that as a lie. Like if I'm talking in code and I'm saying something so that you understand, but they don't understand, then whatever is being directed at them, I think's a fucking lie.
Right.
I mean, that's just kind of, but who am I to question God?
That's right.
Let's
question God. So here are some questions. Why won't God heal amputees?
He does. I've seen it.
You've seen it?
Oh, yes. I've seen it with my own eyes in a video on YouTube.
Oh, yeah? Yeah.
And also, I mean, I've watched him make limbs longer and stuff like that. What you're asking is one of these sort of atheist gotcha questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, God has a plan, and he will heal those whose healing is within the bounds of his plan. But if he doesn't heal a particular amputee, that doesn't mean that God can't heal an amputee. It just means he didn't heal that one because he has a special plan for that person.
Right.
I have a friend of mine. We were just at a wedding last weekend. Unfortunately, because of his diabetes, he had to have a below-the-knee amputation of his legs. Now, maybe God will heal him and grow that limb back. Maybe he won't. But if God just went around healing all amputees, they wouldn't learn their lesson.
Right.
And there would be too much scientific evidence of miracles, and then everybody would just be forced to believe.
I see.
God has to be cagey.
Okay.
And lie.
But what if you pray for it?
Well,
oh, great proxy of God.
Prayer is not a vending machine.
Oh,
God
Jesus
is not a vending
is.
Machine where you put prayers in and
Jesus
what you want
it
comes
is.
Out.
So God answers all prayer except when he doesn't.
Oh, sometimes he says no, or maybe, or later, or wait.
Yeah, right.
God, I'm going to have to shower right after the show, but go ahead.
Okay. All right. There's actually a very good website, Why Won't God Heal Amputees?
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant. I highly recommend folks read it. And there's an article on that website called Why Won't God Heal Amputees that I highly recommend as well. If you read one thing, read that. Is there free will in heaven?
No.
Okay. No.
Because there's not free will either way.
Oh, okay. Well.
Let's put that aside. If you talk to like the Calvinists.
Right. There's no free will, right?
There's no free will.
Okay. Well, supposedly there's no evil in heaven. So
right.
If there is free will, then it's possible to have both free will and the absence of evil in a place.
That's the problem, and that's why I have always, even, and I'll take my hat off for a second to put it back on, when I was a believer, always understood that in the libertarian view of free will, of you can do whatever, that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of free will that I believed in as a Christian was you are free to accept or reject God. God gives you that freedom. But by the time you get to heaven, the only people who will be in heaven are people whose character is such that they have given, subjugated and given themselves over to God such that they would never even want to.
So technically,
God would at that point allow you to do something that was, we would normally consider free will. It's just you wouldn't want to do it.
Okay.
It's like saying, I'm free to kill people, but I will never do that. And so because of that, I'm safe around people. And so God picks out the people who would never do the things that he doesn't want them to do, and those are the people who go to heaven.
Okay. Okay, so it's basically a post hoc rationalization, I guess.
Yes.
Okay. To continue on a little bit, if there is no free will in heaven, you're just a mindless robot in Disneyland.
I think so.
Yep. And
it's God, a small world.
God could have done that here too.
Yeah. The better question for me is, if God already knows who's going to end up in heaven and who's not, then why create all the people who aren't? And why not just create a bunch of people in heaven who he knows is already going to get there?
There you go.
Why are we dancing through all these hoops?
Right. And why do we have this crazy gift of free will?
Because
it doesn't seem to make a difference. Okay. Did God intend Jesus' death?
Yes. It was planned from the beginning.
Okay. So there is this idea that Jesus died for your sins, and it was a perfectly executed plan. And the subsequent systematic murder of Jews is just a demonstration of the wanton evil of Christianity.
Yeah. Well, no. It's a demonstration of God's power. The fact that God knew we would screw it all up, that, you know, it's not like when he stuck Adam and Eve down in the Garden of Eden, he was like, I wonder what they'll do. He knew that they were going to eat from that tree, and they knew the order they were going to eat. You know, they're going to eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil first, and then he's going to have to punish them, and then that's going to bring sin into the world. All of this was part of the plan that he decided he was okay with.
The best possible plan.
But it's our fault.
Right.
Yeah.
It's our fault.
Don't ever mistake. It's our fault. And by the way, it's mostly women's fault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they're the ones that were tricked by the serpent in the first place.
Right, you got to blame the woman.
Men just did what the women told them to do, which generally we think is wise.
Yeah.
Like, I
happy
wore this
wife,
shirt today
life,
because
right?
I was, would you wear my shirt on the show? Yes, I will wear your shirt on the show.
Okay. Well, if God did not intend Jesus' death, then the whole thing was kind of a screw-up.
Yep.
And the Jews are getting blamed for the mistakes. Was Jesus' death a sacrifice?
Well, atheist hat. I wish I had like two hats. I need two hats.
Right.
So atheist hat. No, that wasn't a sacrifice. Oh, you're going to beat me up and make me feel really bad and then kill me for a weekend and then I get to be God forever. That's not a sacrifice. That's like,
and the guy upstairs, his favorite thing is killing. So
yeah. But I mean, swap hats. Well done. It's not just his death that was the sacrifice. For God to take human form and subjugate himself to a world of sin, to allow himself to be tempted by Satan, to allow himself to be in the presence of fallen beings in order to eventually take all of their sin and suffering on him, his mere existence was already a great sacrifice. Can you imagine being the all-powerful governor of the universe and then voluntarily taking human form, to be surrounded in...
Sounds like theater.
Going down into the sewer. That was a sacrifice.
Oh, okay.
There we go. And he did it because he loves you.
Right. And who exactly is this sacrifice for?
The people that God likes.
No, it's the sacrifice was to God himself, right?
Oh, yeah, you know, so he sacrifices himself to himself to serve as a loophole, yeah.
Yeah, right, for laws he made up, right?
But he did it for us.
Uh-huh, okay.
Well, at least not you and me, us, because we're fucked. But he did it for the other people, the people he wants to save.
Okay. This one I've talked about before. Why did Christians stop killing Jews?
Because it was convenient to sidle up to them in order to work against a common enemy.
Oh, the atheists, I guess?
Yes.
Oh.
There's no such thing as Judeo-Christian. That's a garbage word that was invented.
Oh, my goodness.
So yes. Christians would fight Jews, and Protestants would fight... See, Protestants and Catholics won't get along until there's a common enemy. Ooh, Jews, let's go after them. And then Christians and Jews won't get along until there's a common enemy. Ooh, Muslims. And then Christians, yes. Jews, and Muslims won't get along.
Beware of ecumenicism.
Until we start to take over.
Okay, right.
Then all of a sudden you'll find, I'm a Judeo-Christianologist.
Right. And the United States was founded on...
By the way, I'm trademarking that right now, Judeo-Christmanologist t-shirts. That design is mine, which means somebody's going to have one made and ready to order before the show's over.
Right. So, briefly, it was the biggest theological event of the 20th century, yet no seminary seems to know about it. They don't seem to teach it. Martin Luther was a big anti-Semite. Hitler picked up his plan and executed it. During the Holocaust, 6 million Jews were killed. And the Jews get blamed. Let his blood be on us and our children, according to Matthew 27:25. So why did it stop? So either Christianity was wrong for millennia for killing Jews, or it was wrong to stop now. Which is it? Either way, you're kind of screwed. Next one, does your church have a bank account?
Well, my church doesn't.
Yeah.
But most churches that I know of have a bank account.
Right, right. But Matthew preaches, don't worry about the future. God will take care of you.
Oh, but that's not – a church's bank account is not the church worrying about the future of people. It's about the church ensuring that the church persists because God has commanded that.
Oh, okay.
The fact that you think those two commands from God are in conflict doesn't mean they actually are. You're a fallen being who can't understand this.
Can't understand these things, yes. Right? And if your church is not following Jesus, then why should you? Does your church carry insurance is another question.
I don't know.
Does any of the religious magic protect against acts of God?
I think they still make insurance claims. I'm pretty sure they still call the fire department when their church catches fire when lightning strikes it.
So if your church carries insurance, then insurance is a waste of money if God takes care of you. But
it's not necessarily, though, that they don't believe. It's that the current laws that we have require them to carry insurance. They're still confident God will save.
So they should just, you know, not file claims when there's a problem, right?
Yes. That's exactly what should happen. So I understand the law requires your church to carry insurance, but you should be confident that if God wants your church to survive, it will do so without insurance. And so when something bad happens, the law does not require you to file a claim. As far as I know, I have a lawyer in the back room who can double check me, but I don't think you're ever required to actually file an insurance claim. You may be required to carry insurance, and you would only have to do that to pay off, you know, whoever you actually owe and stuff. But if that's the case, why don't you just pray for the money?
Yeah.
Seems to work.
Prayer works, right? Next one. What becomes of the souls of miscarried babies? Are they tortured forever for having original sin and not professing belief in Jesus? That's kind of sick and evil.
No. They automatically go to heaven.
They automatically go to heaven.
By the way, it doesn't say that anywhere in the Bible, but that's the shit that Christians make up in order to comfort themselves and so they don't have to answer this question.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And if they get a free pass, then why not kill them?
Yeah.
Look,
I'm going to put a soul into her, but I'm not going to make that soul responsible and subject to sin until after it's actually, well, either born or reaches the age of reason.
Right.
Depends on which church you're in as to what bullshit they've made up. But it does mean that, like we mentioned before, Andrea Yates was essentially trying to follow. If her understanding of doctrine was correct, she did the most loving thing she could do.
Yeah. I think her reasoning was theologically sound, even though she was cray-cray.
Yeah. Well, if you can guarantee that your children are going to go to heaven by potentially damning yourself, and you do that, what could be more loving?
That's right. It's a sacrifice.
And if heaven's actually better, what are we waiting for?
Okay. And practically speaking, abortions are not much of a moral problem, right? Because
it's a get out of jail free card.
Right. Okay. So if you're bored sitting, if you're a teenager or, non-believer or questioning and you're sitting bored in church someday, start asking these questions and watch the minister squirm. Watch for the spin and the equivocation.
Let me tell you what's going to happen with most of these questions. So
you'll get a pat on the head.
Jokes aside, I've asked some of these questions while I was still a believer. Mm-hmm. These are questions that theologians have been asking each other, and you're going to get different answers based on doctrine of which church or which denomination you're talking to. But what happened to me most of the time and what I see happen to a lot of other people is this. Ask me a difficult question about God.
What's his middle name?
Herman, because that's what the H in Jesus H Christ stands for.
Okay.
No. If so, like the one about what happens to babies that die.
Okay.
Or what happens to the souls of babies that die.
Okay.
The answer that you're actually most likely to get is, we don't know. That's something that God hasn't revealed to us, but we know that God is truthful and loving and compassionate. And so we must just trust that God is going to do the right thing because God can't do the wrong thing. That's the sort of answer that you get. It is a complete non-answer. It is an acknowledgement that we don't. So this whole thing of we don't know would be problematic, except that the full answer is, I don't know, but God knows, and I trust that God knows, and you are wrong to not just trust that God knows. There's right. Something you have not been walking in your, walk with Christ correctly. You have some sin in your life that is preventing you from trusting that God knows the answer.
And you, minister, must be in the same boat because he must, in this personal relationship with him, he must not be trust you enough with the right answers.
And if you are lucky enough to get to heaven, there's no guarantee that God will ever explain himself because God doesn't have to explain himself to you. You are so small that you could not possibly even understand it.
Browbeating.
This is why you just needed trust. Let go and let God.
Right.
I mean, it's buzzwords. It's T-shirts. It's let go and let God.
Okay. All right. Well,
that was
I'm fun. Done.
That
I'm
was
done.
Fun.
That's good enough.
do you have a particular caller you wanted to start with?
Oh, no. Go do
all right.
Whatever you want.
We'll start at the top. We got Tom in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on with Don and Matt. How are you?
I am great. How are you guys?
Not too bad. I had an enjoyable weekend. We are being responsible and we are being alert and worried, but not panicking about the current situation.
Yeah, same here. I heard you grew up in St. Charles, Matt.
Yeah.
I also grew up in St. Charles.
Where out?
Kind of neat.
I graduated from. Oh, go ahead.
What street?
Well, I don't need to know the street. I just somewhere in St. Howell. Cool. I graduated from Howell in 1987. I lived at one point at 260 Big Sky Drive in the Hunters Point subdivision.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I lived off of Youngerman.
I know exactly where it's at. I drove down that road many times and went to First Baptist Church of Harvester, which I think has since maybe changed its name. And it's the one that now has the big lights pointing up into the sky when you drive down, is it 94?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't know if they still have those lights, but I know exactly that church. Yeah, I've driven past that a lot too. So.
Yep. All right. So anyway, how can we help you out besides reminiscing?
I'm on a vibrant journey with my faith. And I'm a musician, a strolling violinist, actually. So, there's a lot of stuff I can talk about. First, though, I wanted to tell you my way out of the maze that I was born into. Like, as you may have known, Missouri, St. Louis is a home to Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Yeah.
Like, it's a historical place. And the brand of LCMS I grew up in was very fundamentalist, like, our particular congregation, especially, not all are like that, but mine was. And I just want to see if you can look over my arguments out of fundamentalism, step by step. And like, you can play devil's advocate and you can challenge me and please feel free to, but I wanted to start there. And then my second purpose of the call was to tell you why I'm still kind of on the fence, a believer and a hopeful in God. And even if it's irrationally, I still have that.
You are far, 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 okay. far, far from alone. So let us know. Go ahead. Tell us what you're thinking.
Okay. Thank you. Number one, I grew up born into the church. And over time, I asked myself, why am I wanting to die so much? And I'm going to explain. I handled the whole Bible. The Bible was all or nothing. And it was really tough, such as teachings about the sinful nature, hell, I had this underlined three times, poor, miserable sinner, and things about my sexuality. Those were all tension, and I had questions, and the Bible always had to be right and stuff. So I was reaching a point where something had to change. And here's why I finally changed. I didn't think God wanted me to live like this. It was like my depression was a worse sin than if I were to just disobey otherwise. And I was at times useless and debilitated by, this events of stuff that was all tied to religion. So that's my first thing. Are you with me so far? Do you?
Sure. Congratulations. Kind of a healthy choice, I think.
Cool. So secondly, then I felt I can change my interpretation of the Bible and feel like I don't have to take all of it all the time. There's a verse that says homosexuals will not inherit the kingdom. Flat out literally interpreting it like that.
That's one of the mild ones about homosexuals.
So it was maybe God is okay if I only read certain verses at a time that help me not be depressed and whatever. And then it was wait a minute, how can I do this? Isn't the Bible all or nothing? Isn't it a slippery slope if I ignore one part of the Bible? I'll end up ignoring the resurrection and my belief system was based on the historical veracity of the resurrection. Like as Paul says in some,
Christ be not raised, then our faith is in vain.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'd always had, did you want to say?
No, I was just agreeing that that's what it says.
Okay, great. Thanks.
And actually is a sound cornerstone for Christianity. If in fact there was not a resurrection, then the entirety of Christian faith is in vain. The problem is that there's no good reason to think that there was a resurrection.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm still grappling with that very cornerstone. And I'll get to that later. Okay. Thanks for bringing that up. And so I'd always had serious doubts and was unwilling to embrace the whole Bible, I realized. So step three was, then I started asking, how much can we be sure that the biblical canon is all correct? And there were proof texts in the Bible that say allude to its inerrancy, all scripture is God breathed. What does that mean? Scripture. And then there's what is scripture? And it was other verses that say God cannot lie, that seem to string together a view that you can trust the Bible and the authors. But I was asking questions who decided the canon? And was it really an organically assembled thing? When I talked to my Lutheran pastor, he said that it was an organically assembled, almost like Amazon reviews. Different communities would have the Bible books and they would kind of largely agree. It's not neat and tidy, but they largely agree what was reliable. If you want to take some time, I'm wondering if you know anything about that. That process, that I'm curious about that. I need to do more research, but that, what do you think of how the canon, if you want to comment, you don't have to, but I'll shut
up. Maybe is there a good a book recommendation on that?
On what?
Yes. Oh, the biblical canon.
I bought a book.
So you can start at Wikipedia and other sites that will go through the canonization process. But really, the short version is that Athanasius of Rome basically made a list of books. And when that list of books was challenged by other people, there were a bunch of religious leaders who argued. And ultimately, the ones that became canonized were the list that Athanasius had. But how the canon came to be is more of an academic thing because it's secondary to whether or not it's actually real. And what you're kind of describing in your journey, which is why I was grabbing my phone, reminds me of my friend Jerry DeWitt's process. He was a Pentecostal preacher and is now an atheist. And he came up with something along the lines of the five stages of grief for him finding his way out of this. And the first thing he gets to is that, God loves everyone. and, you know, then God saves everyone. And then after that was God is in everyone. And the next thing he got to after that was God is everyone's internal dialogue. And that gets to God is a delusion. and the, you're not wrong. So I grew up in the, you know, you don't get to cherry pick the Bible. The truth is every Christian cherry picks and interprets to however is convenient for them. And most of them don't know most of what's in the Bible anyway. They know, hey, this is what the pastor talked about. And I've got this verse memorized. And I went to Vacation Bible School and I learned these three verses and got a little sticker on my thing. And therefore I'm a Bible scholar. You know, and it's like, even you went to a verse about homosexuals that allows you some latitude. If instead you go to, if a man lies with a man as he lies with a woman, they are an abomination and deserve to die.
Yeah.
I don't know of any way to interpret that. Now, I do know that people will say that that's not an instruction for us to kill the gays. It just means they're deserving of death and God will, you know, so that's how you can get to love the sinner, hate the sin. But it does mean that anybody who engages in two men who engage in gay sex, you know anything about this, Don?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. That God thinks that they are deserving of death. Now, Don, when did you choose to be gay?
From my earliest memories of being with other boys.
Yeah.
You know, I was interested in boys.
Tom, do you feel that this is something that you chose or it's just what you are?
Oh, man. It's complicated. I'll say it's definitely part of who I am. And I don't know. I'm still working on it. I am still working through it.
The thing is,
don't beat yourself up.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. Let yourself off the damn hook.
it may be one of the best things you can do is to not worry about the canonization process or what particular verses say and what they don't say, but look at it in the abstract.
Oh, yeah.
And let's do that. Let's look at it in the abstract real quick. Let's say there is a God. Let's say I'm God, because I enjoy that. I don't know if we got any prayer requests.
Right. You seem to like that quite a bit.
I love being God.
Yeah.
So now I've created a universe, and I've created people, and I've created sexuality. Now, there's two options. Either someone engages in a... And we should point male on male homosexual acts, which are distinct and different from female homosexual acts in the Bible. But we're just going to go with gay sex. So there's two reasons that somebody could have gay sex. Either they are, always have been, and are fundamentally just attracted to men, or they are in a situation where this is what they're going to do. Does it really matter whether there's like a genetic contributor or anything? Does any of that change the fact that here's somebody who is not doing anything that is harmful to anybody, you know, that is loving, that is between consensual adults, and yet I, as God of the universe, am like, you know what? That particular sex act, that one right there, no, that one, and yes, everything that's in that ballpark right there, that's the one I'm going to fuck you up for. The rest of them, as long as you're doing it within a marriage, which I've sanctioned, okay.
Well, anything that wasn't procreative was considered sodomy, right? So
yes,
it didn't matter who was involved.
That's right. Sorry, honey.
takes all the fun out of it, my goodness.
I also was questioning, well, is anal sex between married people, heterosexual anal sex, with God can, you
that's,
know, like
that's
that.
Sodomy.
That's the same thing.
What is it about? So, yeah. Anyway.
All right. So where are you at now?
Totally.
I heard the Virgin Mary has a video camera and likes to watch.
That's point number four. And this will tie into how what you said, you have to take the Bible like all or nothing. How do you know, how do we know that believers know? And at this point, I'm still a believer, you know, like in the Bible. How do I know that inspired authors couldn't have made a mistake or had a bad day in their writings? Peter and Paul dig at each other and even corrected each other for, like, Paul was...
On circumcision, they argued back and forth.
Yeah, the circumcision party. And
by the way, forced infant circumcision is just fucking wrong. It just is. It doesn't matter if whether there's ultimately a health benefit or whatever. Forced infant, your routine infant circumcision is grossly immoral no matter what your holy book says, period. Anyway.
Thank you.
Sermon aside.
It may be that the answer here, though, for you is that, you know, you can figure these things out from first principles. And if the Bible has the wrong answer, then you pitch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Oh, and I was going to say that I wanted to bring up, like, my restoring, you can restore your foreskin. And my journey to restoring mine is parallel to my journey of taking back my spirituality. And
you can restore the aesthetic, but you cannot restore the foreskin.
Right. You can get the skin over. You can't restore, like, the structures that were
the nerves.
You can still get
the overwhelming, super dense nerve tissue that is roughly the equivalent of the clitoris. You're not getting that back.
Yeah, but at least you can.
And trust me,
that's the point.
As the one cishet straight guy in this conversation, the clitoris is awesome, and I wish I had one.
Yeah, it is.
You're wrecking me, man.
It's fun. Anyway, we're poking too much fun at this, mainly because we're all in a good mood. And you are thinking and you are struggling with stuff, and I don't want to make light of it. It's one of those things where the two of us are coming at this from a slightly different perspective. I, as a former Southern Baptist and a straight guy, and Don, as a gay man who is married to a Catholic gay man. Mm-hmm. And I know there were conversations like that. And for us, it's frustrating that you can sit here and we're not putting this on you. But I've done this show for 15 years and Don's done it for 17 or so. We're sitting here going, holy crap, Tom, just love yourself, Tom, and go understand what you already understand. You are who you are. You know, you're not a bad person. You know, you're not deserving any of this. And yet you've been indoctrinated into, oh my gosh, I must take it all or nothing. Or maybe I can pick and choose. Or maybe I can do this.
That baggage is the station.
How can I pick and choose? Well, that's the thing. How do you know whether that original, which we don't have originals of, represents God?
Right.
How do you know that, even if it all represents God, that God is anything good or deserving? And if God has not come down and corrected this himself, it's his problem, not yours. You're not the one who is in any position to make up anything, any kind of decision about any of this. It's God's responsibility to correct all this. And if you are sitting there, as I was, as a sincere, devout believer, begging God to clear this stuff up, and you're getting no answer at all, nothing that is identifiably from a God, then either that God doesn't exist or that God doesn't care enough about you to answer it, so fuck him. I don't need him. He can squash me like a bug. There's nothing I can do about it. He clearly hasn't. I've been hosting a show for 15 years, and I'm still here. I'm generally speaking better than ever. I'm happier today than I was, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago. I look better today than I did beforehand. When is God going to fuck me up for leading so many people to hell? It's absurd. It is like the monster under the bed. And I know that it is incredibly difficult to get through that. And the reason that you're on the fence and the reason that you are teetering and the reason that you bothered to call us is because you already know it too. You just got to give yourself permission. And if you can't give yourself permission to be you and to follow your heart and to follow your mind, we will give you that permission until such time as you can give yourself that permission.
You got a lot of...
No, I really appreciate
fears and guilt.
What you're saying. And
that are there, yep.
And counseling.
Oh, yeah.
You need to reach out. So we will always recommend recovering from religion because it's not just for people who are out of religion and already recovering. It is for people who are also in, who are questioning, et cetera. And there's also the Secular Therapist Project so that you can get counseling that isn't going to be, well, have you thought about your walk with Jesus and what it might be? Ooh, are these urges that you're having there? Are you sure that's not the devil? Just, you won't get that. You will get sound science-based health care.
Yeah, I've been working with a therapist who's really, he is of my religious background, but he has opened me up to this. And like, I tell him about this show and he loves my questions. And in fact, like, here's why I still believe in God, to get right to it. Like, I have grown up with the irrational fear of hell. And in a previous show, I was going back and listening to the shows. You had a person who called in and you talked about an imaginary friend sort of God, like, and the invisible bus on the street, like, and you said something about hope, it's okay to have hope. Like, you have nothing against hope. Well, my God, my version of Jesus actually loves this. He loves and respects you. He thinks you're a cool guy, and this is, you can reject it, but like, I don't know if anyone's ever told, but like, you guys remind me of Jesus. I'm like, I can picture Jesus, my version of him at least, having a great time. And Google the picture of the laughing Jesus. That's kind of like a new type of Jesus that I'm being exposed to. And there's an irrational reason why I'm still holding on to faith. It has something to do with love, maybe. And I want to be loved irrationally, kind of like almost like a parent loves their kid irrationally. I don't know. The story, even if it's not true, the story itself is very inspiring.
What story is very inspiring?
What story? Okay. The story of Jesus's passion.
Bullshit.
Really?
Yes.
Like, are you considering all the mean stuff and like what I would call the crappy stuff in the Bible, like kill all these people, and like you're taking it all, right? You're kind of taking the whole Bible as a whole.
I can take it all, or I can just go with the Jesus story, or I can just go with the Sermon on the Mount. The thing is, the story about Jesus. Oh my gosh, God comes down and takes human form in order to sacrifice himself in order to save us all. Oh, look, the Bible is the only example where the mighty sacrifices themselves for the undeserving. If you only cherry pick out that, then yes. Oh, it's a passionate story of how I'm going to save you.
Yeah.
Why did we need to be saved in the first place? And how does blood sacrifice save anybody?
Who are we being
and why
saved
can't
from?
God, if God wants to actually forgive people, why can't God just forgive people? Why does he have to come down and do a blood sacrifice and all of this other stuff? Why does the smell of burning blood and burning flesh ease God's anger? And what exactly did we do? Why is inherited sin, the sin of our fathers to the fourth and the seventh generation carried down upon the children? None of that makes any sense. You can't have the sacrifice and atonement. You can't have the passion story of Christ unless there is sin, inherited sin, and a need for blood sacrifice. If you throw those things out, all you have is a story of somebody who's trying to help you. And yet that person is all powerful, makes all the damn rules, and decided that the best thing they could do is to take human form and die and suffer, give up a weekend, part of a weekend, so that people who believe can go, or the people who are chosen can go, because it didn't save everybody. It just supposedly gave people some sort of pathway to salvation. I find nothing redeeming in that at all. It is repugnant, the notion of infinite torment for finite crimes, or worse, somebody else's crimes.
Don't forget the follow me or be tortured.
You don't have to take the whole Bible. You don't have to go to, you know, the earth is 6,000 years old. You don't even have to believe that God told Moses to go and slay all the Midianites and keep the virgin girls for himself without wondering exactly how did they figure out who was a virgin or not. How is that remotely fair? You can toss all of that out and just look at the passion, but you cannot look at this, at the passion story, without the need for it, that God created a world that humans brought sin into, that God knew he was going to bring sin into, and that we had no say over any of this, and yet somehow we are all guilty, and that some sort of blood, it's gross, it's disgusting. I don't find it redeeming, inspiring, or anything else. You know what I find inspiring? Doubting Thomas.
What?
Somebody who wants actual evidence, that I find inspiring. I find plenty of inspiring things in the Psalms. And in the book that was almost certainly written by a non-believer struggling with these questions, what I really find inspiring is nothing that's in the Bible, but the fact that I know human beings, I know secular humanists who will go out and do good because it's good, because it benefits other human beings. God cares less about human beings than any secular humanist I've ever met. He's playing favorites. Oh, I'm going to give Paul or Saul a Damascus Road experience. None of the rest of us get that.
Yeah.
There's no sound epistemology here. God could reveal himself at any moment and let everybody know. And God could forgive everybody at any moment and just say, nope. But nope, you're undeserving. And for that, we have to have blood sacrifices and bullshit. Because that's what it is.
Yeah. A lot of what you're saying really does resonate with me. And
the rest of it will at some point, I hope.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm going to listen back to this. So thanks for all the time. I don't, there is more I think about. And before I go, I would like to play you a little something. One, two, three, four. So you think that you can tell me how to live our life up or something? I wonder.
I will try to make sure that Shelley doesn't sue you over that.
Thank
you so much. I appreciate it, Tom. Appreciate the time. Thanks. We're going to move on to other callers.
He calls again sometime. Let us know how he's doing.
But it's cool. Something. It reminds me that, so when Shelley was here last time and I played it on the uke and she played it on the guitar, and there's one moment where my fingers didn't cooperate and I didn't go to the A minor that I was supposed to. And immediately there's like an email. It's like, I saw you miss that chord, Matt. I did, because I don't do this shit for a living. I'm not as awesome as Shelley. All right. That's strange.
We've had a couple folks dropped off.
CJ in Raleigh, North Carolina, you wanted to ask a question, potentially, I guess, about the debate I'm doing tomorrow?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was wanting to ask. Got to admit, I'm kind of nervous right now. I was wanting to know generally, what do you think about David Wood as a, do you consider him to be like a heavy contender or pretty much the same, or just was wanting to know, what do you feel about debating him?
Okay, so tomorrow around 3 o'clock in the afternoon or so, I'll be here in the studio doing another one of the modern day debate series, and I'll be debating David Wood. I've watched him one time when Murphy and I went to Oklahoma for Murphy to debate him.
What are you debating about?
Which is a better foundation for ethics, God or secular humanism?
Oh, good question.
Yeah, it's actually a shit question, what we think the question is good and something that's worth discussing. The particular phrasing of doing God versus secular humanism is a big problem, which I'll address. I don't want to talk about my thoughts about David specifically because I don't know the guy that well. I know his backstory. I know that he is a diagnosed psychopath who
surprised me that he believes in the Bible.
Well, at the time when he tried to kill his father with a hammer or something like that, and ended up in jail. But it was in jail that somebody basically, introduced him to the story of Jesus in that foundation, and that fundamentally turned his life around. But it's not like it cured his psychopathy. He's still, in the same thing. Now, we're going to be having a discussion about morality. I don't care. So the question that was asked was, is he a heavy contender apologist? Well, no. I mean, just in the sense that I don't think he's as well known as some other apologists. But that doesn't matter to me. I'm interested in having discussions and with people who may present different views, if for no other reason than at some point all of these apologists who have showed up and tried to debate, maybe they'll get together in a room and figure out which one of them is actually right, and then, come as a group to say, we are now in agreement on this point, and here's why we think you're wrong. Because right now I'm getting different answers from different people. But when I prep for a debate, I don't prep for the person, because the person is irrelevant. I prep for the question or the subject of the debate. And if I instead prepare for a person, now all of a sudden I run the risk of more ad hominems, or I run the risk of preparing for a position that maybe that's not what they're going to present. Debates take place in that time. It's one of the reasons why I work the way I do. I don't know what's coming through on the phone on the show. I mean, there's a call screener thing that kind of says a little bit, but I don't know what a caller is going to say. And so being able to respond on the fly is a skill to have. So in the same way that you got to be careful with phrasing. I'd say I don't care who's on the phone. The person that I'm speaking to on the phone is irrelevant to the argument that they're making and the evidence that they're presenting. And the same thing's true in a debate, whether it's David or Matt Slick or Mike Lacona or William Lane Craig.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess that gives me what's going to happen. I mean, I'm aware that you yourself have said that, you like to be anonymous, or like to not know as little about your opponent. So that way, the conversation could carry on as it went, or something like that.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. If there's a, like, if I was debating William Lane Craig, of course I'm going to, well, actually, I don't have to go back and because I already know how to do that. But you present a new debate opponent, and they've done a lot of debates. I will probably go back and listen to some of what they've done to see if they come up with some of the same arguments, because it would be silly to not be prepared for a specific argument that they give every time. Like, Craig is almost always going to give either the calm cosmological argument or some version of the moral argument if the subject is there a God? But I was in New York City to have a discussion with Dinesh D'Souza. That's now available online. It was supposed to be about God, Trump, and the future of America. I did not go back through and watch a lot of Dinesh's stuff. I probably spent 2 or 3 minutes actually looking up stuff about him and what he had said, because if I walk in with all of this baggage, then it becomes, here, let me show up with a list of quotes of shitty things that Dinesh has said. Hey, when you said this, do you still hold to that? Do you think? And now all of a sudden it's like an interview where you're just trying to expose that this person is bad, when I'd rather have a conversation about ideas. So the discussion that we had didn't really focus on God, Trump, and the future of America, which is what it was supposed to, because we started with God, and that got derailed into epistemology, which veered off into climate change, trans issues, and healthcare is kind of where we went. I mean, Trump barely got mentioned. And the key point, which I got to, is what you're seeing is a secular humanist who's focused on policies and principles that affect human beings, against a neocon who every time I, or almost every time I ask him a question, he goes to what the markets are doing or how people are spending their money or this stuff. That is a completely separate focus. Like, I'm happy to be broke for the rest of my life as long as I'm doing good and I'm doing good.
Yeah. Well, I think what you said about with, in general, with the debates, I think a lot of the times, many of the people who debate William Lane Craig, at least when I've seen like Sam Harris and Robert M. Price, like when you see like their first openings, they can pretty much are, you can tell that they're determined to just eviscerate the dude. And so, you know, they don't care about necessarily how the debate goes. Right. They just want to eviscerate the dude because of his tap dancing necessarily.
Yeah. And I didn't want to walk into to the debate or discussion with Dinesh. It's clear. Once upon a time, he and I agreed on stuff. I changed my mind about many, 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 many things. And he's still holding to those things. And I would rather have a discussion about that. And I was able to expose how awful he was on trans issues, which actually got me an email from a woman in the UK who's thinks I'm really wrong about trans issues. And she's fully supportive of men being able to dress up or even have surgery and all that stuff, but they're still men and they're now poisoning women's issues and women's rights issues. And I went back and forth really quickly, and it was like, you know, she's like, I'm just tired of people calling me a TERF. And I was like, well, if you're a feminist, then you're a TERF, T-R-E-R-E-F, T-E-R-F, trans exclusionary radical feminist. But if you're not a feminist, then you're not a TERF. You're just a fucking bigot.
Yeah. Well, in general, I mean, I feel like let's say, like, for example, like the reason, another thing about David Wood, with him being a psychopath, defending the Christian God, do you think if he was an idiot, he'd be more likely to defend something like, what kind of God do you think he would defend necessarily if he was necessarily a complete idiot as opposed to a psychopath?
I don't know remotely how to answer that, because I don't know that the two are mutually exclusive. I don't know what it means to be a complete idiot. But also, you believe in whatever you believe in. So rather than setting up a fictional David Wood for me to knock over on the show, why don't we just do the thing tomorrow and talk over what David's position is and address the position and not the person, or some fictional version of the person. I was strawmanned enough in New York with Dinesh that I don't have any interest in strawmanning somebody else.
Yeah.
But on that note, CJ, we're going to get some more calls. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time. And yeah, it's going to be interesting. You know, not to spoiler ruin everything, but I tried to have it be, which is a better foundation for morality, Christianity or secular humanism. And when I suggested that topic as opposed to God, because originally he wanted God versus atheism, and I was like, neither of those things are ethical systems. They don't have positions on this. So let's do Christianity versus secular humanism, because now at least you're talking about two worldviews that are supposed to be about this. But his thing was, if we changed it to Christianity, he'd need an extra 2 weeks to prepare Now, while I just said
I'm confused,
I'm more interested in the topic and the discussion than I am the person. That's an embarrassing load of crap, because if you're not coming in to defend the Christian worldview and just God, you have already lost. And my opening statement in the debate will make this crystal clear that there is zero way that David can ever win this debate. It can't ever be more than I assert that God is the best foundation for morality, because you have no access to that. But why on earth would it take you 2 extra weeks to prepare to defend what you actually fucking believe? You're supposed to be a Christian apologist. You're supposed to be a defender of the faith. You are required under 1 Peter 3:15 to be prepared at all times, not in 2 weeks. Be prepared in 2 weeks to give the judge. It's bizarre to me, but that's what he wants to defend. And maybe it's the one shot that he'll get to, you know, to debate at this level, because quite frankly, this debate is over before it starts, which sucks, because there's a real discussion to be had here about ethics. And also we got into it about format, because I wanted, you know, hey, here's a couple 15 minutes openings and then an hour of discussion and then Q&A. He wanted 2 12-minute openings, 2 8-minute first rebuttals, 2 5-minute second rebuttals,
very structured, yeah.
Then closing arguments, or then some discussion, then closing arguments, and then questions and answers. And I'm like, why would you do closings before question and answers? What if something comes up there that you want to expand? You know, why do I need 2 rebuttals? Can't we just work that all into a discussion where we're asking each other questions? And don't you get more by saying, in your opening, when you said this, what exactly did you mean? And do I understand this? Or how is this not this way?
Mm-hmm.
But this, I'm going to make an opening statement. You're going to make an opening statement. Then I'm going to rebut your opening statement. Then you're going to rebut my opening statement. Then I'm going to re-rebut your opening statement. Then you're going to re-rebut my... I'm not here to earn points. This is not collegiate debate. I don't care about structured formats. That is... The structure, the script of both the debate and what you're going to say is what's going to make you end up, David, looking foolish, because you stuck with a particular topic and you stuck with a strict format. And that's not just me shit-talking. That's me actually caring about having good discussions, because I'm not convinced that this strict format and particular topic is actually going to get there. As a reminder, we're on the air till 6 p.m., so another 25 minutes or so, and then a new episode of The Nonprofits will air immediately after this show. It was recorded yesterday.
And we are not inviting folks down for dinner
because
of the coronavirus.
Yeah, this is the we're broadcasting from the Atheist Community of Austin's Freethought Library, a bastion for secularism. It's like Mecca, maybe, except don't come down because of the coronavirus.
That's right.
And so all the dinner.
Hopefully this will all be over soon and we'll get back to normal.
Yeah, normally it's open to any atheist or atheist-friendly person every day from 11 to 9, but right now it's not. And all that, we have food brought in, and normally at this point, you know, we'd be saying, hey, by the way, we're going to have this for dinner, but I'm not going to tell you because you don't get to come down and have any. And so we're going to have more food than any of these people could possibly eat, so we're going to pack it up. We're going to let some people take some of it home, and then whatever's left over, I'm going to go find homeless people in Austin who need some food,
awesome.
And we're going to do that.
Awesome.
All right.
Let's take another call or two. What do you think?
Sure. We've got, I can't, it says Hassan, is it butterfly or bee fly?
Well, it's bee fly, but it's short for butterfly. It does.
All right. So I didn't know if we just ran out of room on the name and they shortened butterfly to bee fly, or if you had shortened butterfly to bee fly. So how you doing, Hassan?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
All right.
All right. What do you got for us? It says here, God is to existence as zero is to math.
That's kind of close. It's God is to reality.
Okay.
And it's basically, whenever I hear the atheist versus theist debate, and I've heard it so many times, it's ridiculous. The atheists point out the contradictions within religion, which there are plenty, because, you know, the idea of, you know, this humanoid God contradicts the idea of a premise. I mean, the premise of a creator. But then the theists normally go and say, well, look at the universe as evidence that there must be a creator, which, you know, y'all laugh at, but it kind of makes sense, to a certain extent. And by that, I mean, you know, I'm going to say that the role zero plays within math mirrors everything that is supposed to be about God besides the emotional temper tantrum.
So you mean like a placeholder?
No, zero is an important concept within math.
Yeah.
And it is the most important concept, is essential.
Well, I'd say it's half of the most important concept, because...
What would be the other half?
Well, that's what I was getting to. So math is founded on the logical principles of identity, non-contradiction, excluded middle. And so if you had zero and nothing else, you would have nothing. Conceptually, zero is just contracted with things that are not zero. It's the thing that allows us to show, hey, if I have three apples and I take away three apples, I have no apples left. It is not just a placeholder or a digit. It is a concept of the absence of something, but it is also the only way. Well, it's not the only way you could do math, because zero didn't always exist as a concept in math. It was, in matter of fact, it's not even pre-recorded history. It's part of recorded. Is it 7th century Islamic?
Yes. 7th century, yes.
However, the problem is that while that's a concept that is foundational and essential to how we do math, there's no evidence that there is a God which is foundational to the universe.
And I would agree if you're talking about the humanoid concept. I would say that
Hang on.
Well, maybe we need to define God.
Okay, so...
Sorry, my bad.
The humanoids concept. I don't know of any other concept of God, and there's lots of different ones, but they're all from humanoids, because I don't know of too much about concepts that don't come from humanoids.
Well, God was created in our image.
What God are you talking about?
Okay, I'm going to say simply the creator of everything that is measurable.
Okay, but you don't get to assert that there is a creator or that there needs to be a creator. You need to demonstrate that there is a creator or that there needs to be a creator.
Okay, and I think math, which correlates to reality, is the perfect proof.
It's not.
Okay, and that's just an assertion. Why are you saying it's not proof? It's how we prove everything else.
I can use an assertion to respond to an assertion. You're arguing by analogy that because there's a zero concept which is important in mathematics, that there must then be a God concept which is important to reality.
That is not what I'm saying.
What is the evidence for the God?
Okay. Well, first, I thought we wanted to define God.
I would love that, but you didn't.
Okay. Every time I'm doing it, I get interrupted with
a... That's a load of shit. So, I let you... Oh God, we paused to let you define it, and you went to something else, interrupting me.
No, I didn't. You gave me an opportunity.
Play back the fucking recording. That's exactly what happened.
Let's stop with a meta discussion. Let's have a define definition God. For God.
All right. So we're going to I'm defining God as the creator of all. You said I could not do that. And I'm saying that is what every monotheistic, that is the one universal principle within every monotheistic belief, is God is the creator of all. Now,
here's the problem. This is why... This is why when I ask you to define God, if you say God is the creator of all, that doesn't get us anywhere, because there needs to be a demonstration that there is in fact a creator of all.
And I'm saying that zero's role within math...
And I don't give a shit, because that's an argument from an analogy. I'm trying to get you... You need to demonstrate that there is a creator. You can say God is the creator of all. That gets us nowhere. What you need to demonstrate is that there is, in fact, a creator of all, and you don't get to do it by saying it's analogous to what zero does in math. That's not the way we get...
Can I finish my statement, sir?
Sorry?
Can I finish my statement, sir? I was in the middle of a statement before you went on your diatribe. May I finish my statement, sir?
Actually, I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to let you finish your statement, but there are reasons why I interrupt. And they're good reasons, whether you think so or not. And part of it is because I've done this for a long time. And if we don't stop at the first point of disagreement and actually get clarification, then you will go on for a long time, or somebody will go on for a long time, getting us no clearer to understanding or agreement. And then we will have wasted the precious time on the show. So if we're going to define a God, it's fine to say, I define God as the creator of all. Cool. That's a definition. But it didn't move us anywhere, because... Until somebody demonstrates that there is a creator of all, we haven't moved anything. And if your argument that there must be a creator of all because it's analogous to zero, that will never be accepted. Argument by analogy of concepts does not amount to evidence. Try it again.
You're on now.
Am I on now?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you listen to me?
Yes, I listen to you all. Okay. And all right, so you're saying that I understand how. That's how we actually define, or whenever we have a term. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this. Whenever we have a term where there's some vagueness, or whatever word is, vagueness is probably the word, you know, any ambiguity, anything where there's room for confusion, if we can find a congruent relationship, that's how we would show it. So I'm saying,
no.
Roll the zero plate. Oh, my God, please.
All right, now I'm putting your ass back on hold because you just told me to correct me if you were wrong. Did you not say that?
What's that?
Did you not just tell me to correct you if you were wrong?
Okay, and I'm saying, so you're saying we don't have congruency? That's not one way that we can show something.
Did you tell me to correct you if you were wrong?
Are you trying to browbeat me, sir?
Did the words "correct me if I'm wrong" come out of your fucking mouth?
Is that a fucking idiom?
All right, now you're on hold, and you're going to listen to me because the guys in the studio said, you know, sometimes if you just hang up on somebody and then you go into this long explanation afterwards, they're not benefiting from it. Now, all I was saying was you think that I'm interrupting you unjustly, but the words that came out of your mouth were, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we find a congruency, and I interrupted to correct you that you were wrong. I did the very thing that you asked me to do. And so now I'm going to explain this. When we talk about a definition. Cool. God is creator of all. Great. There, now we got a definition. How do we show that the thing that we're talking about is real? And you're saying if we find a congruency. But the congruency that you're pointing to is a congruency with mathematics, which is a concept, the zero concept, which is an argument from analogy, which I already told you I wasn't going to be accepting, and that is not how we would prove a God. We don't prove that there is a Superman because we find one man can run faster than another man. I can barely run, but this guy can run 100 times faster than I can. That must mean that therefore there's a Superman that can fly and reverse the rotation of the earth. That is the sort of congruency that you're doing when you argue by analogy. If you don't have an actual argument and case to make for the God as creator of all, which will be providing evidence that a creator is possible, plausible, necessary, and then existent. That's the process. Not just, can I find a concept somewhere else in the universe? Because we can do that all the time. We can talk about how, hey, Don and I, we are capable of thinking and having emotions. And our capacity for thinking and having emotions is much greater than an ant. And so therefore, by analogy, there must be some being that is that much greater than us. Matter of fact, there must be a being that has an infinite capacity to this, that isn't bound by space and time. You can do this all day long and you get no closer. Now, I'm going to take you off hold now to ask you a question. Did you hear what I said and did it make sense?
I heard you build a straw man for my argument.
Thank you for calling. Goodbye. Hey, Luke in Arizona. Thanks for waiting.
No problem.
It says here your question is, why am I not a nihilist? Or I suppose that's for both of us.
If atheism is about a lack of belief, how come you're not a nihilist?
I am a nihilist, depending on the definition, in the sense that I don't believe there's some intrinsic purpose or meaning to the universe. I believe that meaning is something that, and meaning and purpose is something we imbue the universe with. Just like I don't believe there's an externally imposed plan for my life, but that doesn't mean I don't have a plan for my life. So in the weak or soft sense of nihilist, in the sense that I don't believe there's some intrinsic universal purpose, I am. I'm not a nihilist in the fatalistic sense of none of this matters, because I recognize it matters to me.
So you're not a nihilist because you don't want to be true?
I don't think that's remotely what I said. Don't want what to be true?
Well, if lack of belief is what atheism is, how come you're not a fatal nihilist?
We lack belief in gods. We believe in all sorts of things.
Yeah.
On the basis of what?
On the basis of evidence that, you know, granted, I don't have a solution for the problem of hard solipsism, but I'm convinced that there are other minds, because it would be monumentally arrogant of me to assume that I am, in fact, the only mind. And so because there are other humans that I interact with, and because I have feelings and I have thoughts about things, and things matter in value to me and other humans, there are things that Don tells me matter to him. There are things my girlfriend tells me matter to her. And so recognizing that this is the world that I am experiencing, things matter to me. It doesn't matter to me if the universe has some intrinsic meaning or purpose for my life, or if there's a God who has an intrinsic meaning or purpose for my life, I have a meaning and purpose for my life, and that's enough. What is it that you think I don't want to be true, or that I'm believing that?
So you're a subjectivist. A moral subjectivist.
Well, how did we get to morality? I mean, hang on. It's like you're calling in, you ask about a specific philosophical concept, which is often easily confused. The fatalistic notion of nihilism is one that I don't share. But the nihilism is a simple thing, that the universe doesn't have an intrinsic meaning or purpose in my life. And I explain all of that. And then the first words out of your mouth is that you just believe it because you don't want it to be true. And when I ask for clarification on that, you immediately jump to, so you're a moral subjectivist. That has nothing at all to do with anything I just described. And it's not an answer to my question.
Because it's valuable to you, therefore it's a subjective.
Maybe so.
No. I want to let him actually say something that's useful that pertains to what we were discussing.
Well, it's valuable to you, and only because you like it, therefore it's subjective.
Yes, as I noted, the things that I value are subjective, but that's not, we weren't talking about morality.
But you're making a value judgment.
I'm making value judgments about what I value, but that's not we weren't discussing morality, and subjective morality is a very specific and confusing subject as well, which is that whatever a particular society says is moral, and that's not what my position is. And so you're conflating my acknowledgement of my nihilism in a weak sense, and then wanting to derail to subjective morality when the two aren't necessarily connected, without acknowledging that I answered your question or anything else, or even trying to stay on topic. So it seems like, Luke, you're calling in as if you found what you think is some gotcha. And since we started with gotcha questions, bring it on. Give us the gotchas.
So light nihilism doesn't reinforce your moral subjectivism.
So
I don't think they have much to do with each other.
What we use as a foundation for morality, which I will go with, along with Sam Harris and a number of others, well-being. There's no objective, intrinsic requirement that be a foundation for morality. It is a subjective assessment that this is what we should be going for. Once you have that as the goal, here's where I'm going to define morality as well-being, and yes, it's not completely defined, and that is a subjective determination. But after that, I can make objective assessments about actions to determine if the consequences of those actions further the goal. The goal may be ultimately subjective. The thing is, it doesn't matter whether it's subjective or arbitrary. Just like chess, which I've used as an example over and over again. Ultimately, the rules of the game are arbitrary. We invented the rules of the game. And the goal of the game is to not lose. That's subjective. And so what you're basically doing is I'm talking about how we can play a game of chess, and you're coming in saying, what if I don't care about winning about chess? It's just your subjective opinion. Yes, I'm talking about chess, and I'm presuming that most of the people I'm talking to, do you care about human well-being? Do you care about the well-beings of society? Do you care about finding out what sort of things make society better and what sort of things detract from it? What sort of things make our lives better? Do you care about that?
As a Christian, yes.
Okay, well, I'm not a Christian and I care about it. Why would you as a Christian care about it when the Bible says that this life is like dirty rags and that the real life is the one that starts after we die? You don't have a foundation to care about human interactions at all.
Because I'm obligated to?
No, you're not. You are not obligated to do anything according to the Bible except to represent Jesus and tell people about the future and to allow the Holy Spirit to use you to guide them to determine who will be saved to the real life and who will be saved to eternal damnation. There's nothing about human concerns. Take no concern for the lilies. Take no thought of tomorrow. There's nothing humanistic about Christianity at all. It is a death cult waiting for the real life to start. My view says, you know what? I think this life matters, and it seems to matter. And by the way, I think it matters to Christians too. I'm just saying you don't necessarily have a biblical foundation for it, because that's not the goal. The goal in Christianity is to get to heaven, to spend eternity with the Father. That is the goal, right?
And yeah, because that involves living a righteous life.
No. What living a righteous life is not the path to salvation. Where did you get that?
when you're saved, you're commanded to live a righteous life.
Ah, to live a righteous life when you're saved. But it's salvation that determines whether or not you go to heaven, right?
Right.
Is salvation determined by works?
No.
No. And yet my view is focused on works, doing the things in life that make life better, because I'm focused on this life that we're sharing, that we care about. The living a righteous life, according to most modern Christian denominations, is living in accordance with what God wants you to do, specifically with the focus of becoming, well, God is going to save by grace through, or by faith through grace, whoever he determines. Like, you have no idea who's going to be saved, do you?
Oh, I just know I'm saved. That's all I'm privy to.
How do you know you're saved? Doesn't God, isn't God the only one that knows that? What if God decides not to save you?
Well, then he would let me know.
How do you know that?
The confidence I have in him.
You have confidence in him, but, you know, does he talk to you?
No.
Okay, so has he ever let you know anything?
Yes.
How does he let you know if he doesn't talk to you?
It was a spiritual experience of realization.
Okay, you say it's a spiritual experience of realization. How do you tell the difference between your spiritual experience of realization and somebody else's delusion?
I love to compare and contrast.
Okay, compare and contrast. Why are there over 1,000 denominations of Christianity all claiming to get revelations from God that 30, don't agree?
30,000.
I'll just stick with over.
Individual differences?
Individual differences. And yet they disagree on salvation. They disagree on the character of Jesus. They disagree on whether or not Jesus was real. Yeah. And yet, let me line up here. I used to be a Christian. We'll put you and me and 5 other Christians in the room, and we'll start asking, what's God's take on things? Do you think we're all going to get consistent answers?
Maybe, maybe not.
Okay, maybe not. But if the answer is maybe not, then isn't that an admission that God isn't clearly communicating with people? If God is there to guarantee and provide this certainty that you know you're going to heaven, what if God told one of the others that you're not?
I'd like to know why.
I would like to know why, too. So why doesn't God come down and clear this up instead of having theists call in to talk about whether or not an atheist has any reason to care about the universe when clearly we all do? Isn't it completely obvious that as long as you and I are stuck on this planet, irrespective of your God or your belief in God, you and I benefit from making this world better, right?
But you openly said that your foundational assumption is subjective.
Yes, making the world better is subjective to care about. But what makes the world better is not subjective.
Is that been proven to be true? Am I obligated to do so?
Hang on. You're not obligated to do anything, not even by your religion or your God. You're commanded to do stuff, but you are free to do whatever you want, right?
But I thought we were talking about what we should do.
Yes, we are. And if we agree, if you and I agree that we want to have a better world, and we begin by defining in places and discovering what... So you and I are physical beings in a physical universe, right?
Yes, technically.
Okay, and technically... The laws of this universe, the physical facts about this universe dictate whether or not something is in our best interest or not. Like, it's a physical fact that me lopping off Don's head is not in his best interest right now, given everything, right?
Yes.
Okay. And that drinking battery acid is worse for us than drinking apple juice.
Yes.
And so let's just talk about physical health for a second, because this is directly analogous. So there's nothing in the universe that requires us to be healthy or to care about being healthy, right? We can eat whatever we want. I can give myself diabetes. I can be a vegan or not a vegan. There's nothing about the universe that requires us to care about health, but we care about health, don't we?
Right.
And health is not particularly well-defined, and it will vary a little bit. Some things that are going to be healthy for me aren't going to be healthy for Don, and vice versa, because while we're similar, we're not identical. Now, if it's subjective for us to care about health, does that make facts about health subjective?
Yes.
No. Battery acid is bad for you, worse for you than apple juice. You already acknowledge that. That's not about a preference.
As a Christian.
No. It's not as a Christian. This is just a scientific fact.
No, that's presuming the value of the action.
No, it's not. I'm talking about physical health, and you already acknowledged that drinking battery acid is worse than drinking apple juice for your physical health, right?
Yeah.
That is a fact. That is an objective fact about human beings generally.
Presuming that physical health is good.
Right. Okay, I don't know why you keep trying to avoid this, because I'm in agreement with that. I said that, and I got you to agree. There's nothing that requires us to care about physical health, but...
But we should.
But no, if you and I both care about physical health, then we can discover objective truths about physical health that are non-subjective. It's not a matter of opinion about whether or not you will be healthier if you drink battery acid than if you drink apple juice.
If the foundation is subjective, the answers are subjective.
Wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Well, why?
And I don't know why this is so difficult, because you and I would agree that whether or not there's a God, there are physical facts about human beings that dictate that drinking battery acid is less conducive to your health than drinking apple juice, generally speaking. That is a fact.
Presuming that...
it's not presuming anything. It is a physical fact about the human condition.
Presuming that health is good, yes.
No, it's not presuming that health is good.
Stop.
It's not... I don't know why this is... Let me go back to my chess analogy, because maybe this will clear it up, because now we are over time. I'm going to tie the chess to the health. There is no requirement that we care about winning or not losing the game of chess. But if we agree that you and I agree that we do not want to lose a game of chess, then there are objectively good moves and objectively bad moves with respect to that goal of not losing chess, correct?
Yes.
And if you and I agree that we care about a healthy physical human being, there are objective facts about what is conducive towards health and what is not, correct?
Yes.
And now the only issue is, do we both agree about not losing the game? Do we both agree about physical health? I think that we probably do. Am I correct?
Where'd the chessboard come from?
We made up the chessboard. What? Why can you not answer?
It's an analogy.
I just hand-walked you down a Shut up. I just hand-walked you down a rose garden path to show the distinction between we subjectively care about not losing the game, and once we agree on that, there are objective facts. We subjectively care about human health, and after we agree on that, there are certain facts. And yet, as soon as your brain realizes where this is going, you go to something batshit like, where did the chessboard come from? That's irrelevant. That's the whole point. Chess can be completely...
That's your analogy.
Goodbye. That's the whole point. We can make up a game. We can invent a chessboard. We can invent the pieces. We can make all the rules about the game. It can be completely arbitrary, completely subjective. We've created a game. But once we agree that we don't want to lose that game, now we can begin to assess things. That analogy is there because it's pretty simple. And my caller completely understood it so well that once it was tied from the chess game to physical health, which he also had to acknowledge, he had to keep going back to, why do we care about health? Why? No, it doesn't matter. If we both agree that we care about health, if we both agree that we care about the chess game, there are objective facts to discover. The same thing is true if you and I agree about we would like to have a better world. Now, does that mean we know everything about what a better world looks like? No, but we don't know everything about what health looks like. Does that mean that because there's variations between human beings, that there aren't going to be variations in understanding about what a better world is? Clearly, just in the United States, Democrats and Republicans often disagree on what a better world looks like, and yet they both think they want to get to a better world. And the solution for that is to talk to people and say, okay, what about your view leads to a better world? And when you can find out that somebody's internal model of a better world is actually in conflict, that the thing that they think would make the world better, like if we all had more money, if you can show that there's a problem where all of us having more money actually doesn't lead to what they think is a better world, now you've shown a problem with their definition of better. And we've learned something. Now we've learned we can adjust what our definition of better is. Just in the same way that, hey, I'd like to not lose this chess game. I think this move is better. We can analyze that move, and chess isn't solved, which is why we keep playing it. And we can say, no. Actually, that move that we thought was really good, turns out there's a response to that, and it leads to this. And so somebody can think that their view is better, or they think that their view leads to a better world, and they can be wrong. And this is why there's a difference between subjective morality, which is whatever's right or wrong is just defined by our society, and instead saying a subjective foundation of well-being leads to us exploring and discovering the facts about the universe And we can be wrong about what our view of a better world is. But if we truly have a view of a better world in place, then we are now able to correct our misunderstandings about that. So when you call in and say, why aren't you a nihilist? And I say, I am. And I give two distinct definitions of nihilism to show that I am, but I'm not a fatalist. I don't think that there's pointlessness. I don't need the universe to have a meaning and purpose for my life to have a meaning and purpose. I don't need the universe to have some God or objective intrinsic standard of morality. Not only is there no evidence that that is actually true, but it wouldn't get us anywhere. There is no problem in a secular moral system that is in any way solved by pointing to a God. Because at the end of the day, it's just your subjective assessment that your view of God is the better way. It's just a bald-ass assertion that God is the foundation of morality. As if a God telling someone to kill their child is demonstration of a morality. Well, God knows and understands better than us. He can see farther than us. Fuck him. If he made us so that we have limited sight and we operate within that limited sight and we have the goal of a better world, how dare you come in and tell me that I'm somehow on inferior foundation when your foundation does not care about the one and only life we know we're going to get and instead focuses on trying to attain some other afterlife that you have no control over, no evidence for, and no demonstration that the being that you're appealing to exists or gives a rat's ass about anything. You have taken the entirety of the human experience, everything you are ever going to love, every time you've had sex, every time you've had a great meal, every time you've listened to wonderful music, every piece of art you discovered, every new fact you've ever learned about the universe, and all of it gets scrunched down into a tiny little crappy tinfoil ball to get tossed aside. Because you want there to be this magical land and you want to toss out everything that human beings have learned about how to live a better life because you're too afraid and too lazy to say, you know what? This ancient book that keeps telling me stories that lets me be absolutely convinced I'm going to heaven, even though I have to acknowledge when under pressure, I don't actually know because we don't have any access to that, that there's a God who won't do a damn thing to clear up any of this confusion, that that system is somehow superior. Oh, all right, there's part of my debate for tomorrow. It's crap. We are way over time. I want to thank all the people, the five people who showed up over there on the other side of the glass. Yay. Who are going to have loads of food to eat. Reminder that as soon as we're done, if not already, Nonprofits is starting right now. And that we actually set a new viewer record for live viewers today. Okay. Because evidently everybody is home and not out doing stuff. So thank you, coronavirus,
here, right?
For 6,314 live viewers for the Atheist Experience. The guys on the other side of that wall right there are the ones that make this show happen. Don and I just get to show up and talk and have the fun and interactions.
Yeah,
thanks,
we're
Don.
We're sorry we didn't get the last couple callers. We're sorry.
Yeah, and my apologies to those folks, but we had to go. We'll see you next time.